We call the last case with the Moore L. versus Gus. Now tell me something. Kyle Duncan is on the brief, and you're Stuart Duncan.
Stuart Kyle Duncan, Judge.
Oh, okay. I was going to say.
The brief. That's a mistake on it. It should be S. Kyle Duncan.
Okay. So you are the man himself. I was going to say, there's something. I'm missing something here.
The man himself.
Okay. May it please the court. Stuart Kyle Duncan, for the appellants, Sheriff Marlon Guzman and Chief Deputy William Hunter. My clients made emergency decisions during Hurricane Katrina that saved the appellees' lives. For that, they now face about $1 million in judgment. We asked this court to find they were immune from liability under state and federal law. First, I'll address the false imprisonment claim against Sheriff Guzman. Second, I'll address the Sixth Amendment claim against Chief Hunter. False imprisonment first.
Before you do that, let me be sure. I'm a little confused. Is your client saying that the 48-hour probable cause rule was suspended, or is he saying that release after 48 hours was suspended based on the emergency?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the difference between those two choices. He is saying that there is an emergency exception built into 230.2, which is the 48-hour rule. Characterizing it as being suspended is fair enough, yes. It was suspended by the undisputed emergency circumstances. Another way to put it, I think that...
Well, what my point is this. If that rule is suspended, then there's one result. If that rule of 48-hour was not suspended and the 48-hour run, as it did in this case, is the provision that says if it's not done, then they're entitled to release. Is that what's suspended?
Again, I'm not sure I fully grasp the consequences of that distinction. My client's position is that rule, which is the only basis for finding that their detention was illegal, the 230.2 rule.
So you're saying that your argument is that the need to hold a probable cause hearing was suspended.
That's correct. Our position is the 48-hour rule, which is the only basis for finding an illegal detention, was suspended by the emergency circumstances. That's correct, Your Honor. So therefore, just to build on that, built into that rule, as the County of Riverside case makes clear, is discretion to account for emergency circumstances. In other words, an official like the sheriff is looking at the 48-hour rule going by and saying, yes, it is a requirement to release on 48 hours, but as the U.S. Supreme Court said, you have to account for emergency circumstances. And so in this circumstance, he would have faced the decision to release a pretrial detainee into a storm surge.
Does the record show that somebody affirmatively said the 48-hour rule is suspended? We can't. Because, no, the record doesn't show that because there wasn't any plan to hold a 48-hour hearing anyway.
That's correct, Your Honor. The plan was to go through with the normal procedures, which is, let me back up. The plan was not to evacuate the prison and not to preemptively release anyone. Under normal procedures, the 48-hour hearing would have gone forward on Monday morning. Under these circumstances, though, you have Katrina approaching, and hitting New Orleans during that weekend.
Well, no, it hit on Monday morning.
It hit on Monday
approaching.
Morning, right.
But so there wasn't a decision made about the 48-hour rule. There was a decision made that all of us who are here today, we are all going to stay.
That's correct, right.
Regardless of what your legal status is.
That's
everybody's going to be stay within these four walls.
They're going nowhere.
That's correct.
Nobody going
and
nowhere.
That really is the point. That the decision was made, and this is clear from the record. This is clear from the testimony in the record. The decision was made, here's what we're going to do. We're going to vertically evacuate. That was the term used by the sheriff. We're going to vertically evacuate because these are huge concrete bunkers. They have withstood hurricanes before. Our chances for the thousands of prisoners there and for the prison staff and families, our chances are best if we weather the storm. That's a considered policy-making decision about disaster preparedness. You're right, though, Judge King. There's nothing in the record, and there's nothing in actual reality that said, well, let's make decisions about the 48-hour hearing.
Well, but let me ask you something. It's a question of who gets to be the decision maker, okay?
Right.
The sheriff, I suppose, he thinks he's the decision maker for everybody within the four walls.
He's the final
But policy. If these people were entitled to go, then don't they have a right to make a decision, too?
If there was no emergency exception built into the 48-hour period, the answer would be yes. That's their argument. Their argument says that what the Constitution means and what Article 230.2 means, because they're the same, it means there's a clock running. And when that clock elapses at 5 a.m. or thereabouts on Monday morning, Monday, August 29th, 2005, automatic Fourth Amendment violation and automatic violation of 230.2, ergo, a false imprisonment at that very moment. That is not a correct understanding of 230.2 or Riverside. And more basically, I suppose, it violates what this court said in 1969 in one of the first state false imprisonment cases that this court decided, called Worrell v. Kern, which a couple of months ago this court reaffirmed in a case out of Mississippi called Porter v. Epps. It said on page 792 of that decision, this is cited in our brief, but it said, we are not to be interpreted as holding that a sheriff commits an instant tort at the moment when his prisoner should have been released. And that case wasn't about the 48-hour period. It was about the actual length of sentence, and the guy was held over for 9 months. But the principle is the same, albeit under Louisiana law here. You've got a clock running. The clock runs at 48 hours. So the question then becomes, at 48 hours plus 1 second, does that become a false imprisonment, illegal detention? And in order to answer that question, you have to say, well, that rule includes emergency discretion. The sheriff was unquestionably exercising discretion to lock down everyone in the prison over the weekend period. And by the time the 48-hour period run, there was nothing he could do. Imagine if he had decided to release some subset of pretrial detainees on Monday morning and said, well, I have to comply with the letter of the law. Well, we'd be here on another lawsuit because those people might have died.
Well, maybe. Maybe not.
Well, it was up to the
sheriff.
These
individuals didn't have the greatest judgment in the whole world, and you can understand them saying, all right, I understand a storm is coming, but I'd rather take my chances than I would be to stay here with you all, so I'm leaving.
And they sign a release.
And sign, you know, they'd be gone.
Remember how many people we're talking about here. There were about 1,000, according to the testimony, about 1,000 pretrial detainees.
Arrested over that weekend?
Well, that building, Templeman 3, is normally at full capacity. Sheriff testified that it's typically about 1,000 people.
Now, yeah, but not all 1,000 of those were arrested between...
Misdemeanor retainees.
That's probably true. That's why in our brief we say probably hundreds. It's impossible to know how many. Presumably a lot. But the point is that faced with this looming catastrophe, the sheriff has a decision. Well, the statutes say I have to keep my prisoners safe. So what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to preemptively release some subset of those in order to make sure that they can go on their way. Well, that's a possible judgment, but the sheriff testified that that would have been ridiculous. And Chief Hunter testified that it would have been unsafe to do that. I think that's understating the matter. And remember, the mandatory evacuation order from Mayor Nagin, which was issued on Sunday morning explicitly excluded the sheriff and the prison inmates and all the prison staff for good reason, because there's a different calculus going on with this large mini city within New Orleans that at the time was the ninth largest jail in the United States, housing a lot of undesirable people. So I think we come back to that the sheriff is unquestionably exercising a high level of discretion about disaster preparedness.
I don't know.
And the 48-hour rule has to bend to that.
Now, one of the questions that's raised in your brief is whether Gusman waived his discretionary immunity argument by failing to raise it. And I think that's a serious question here.
I understand.
I mean, you're the lawyer for us. There must have been someone else below,
right,
and this issue wasn't raised.
It was raised in the answer to the original amended complaint, discretionary immunity was. It was raised explicitly, it was raised in the 50B motion, which is the post-judgment motion. It was not raised in the oral pre-verdict.
It was not raised in the pretrial order, which is what sets the rules of engagement for the whole thing. It was not in there.
It does seem to be in the pretrial order.
I'll have to go back and check the pretrial order, Judge.
In the sense, not specifically, but in the sense that he urged that he was entitled to an exception under the Stern case.
Well, that's the Riverside. The Riverside case.
The Riverside case.
That's correct, and that was argued to the jury, and it was a jury instruction as well, the emergency exception to 230.
He did not argue the Louisiana statute.
That's correct.
That there was an exception that he should be entitled to.
The emergency exception to 230.2.
There's a difference between the emergency exception and the discretionary immunity defense, and he did not raise that.
That's
right.
That's correct. However, the appellees are precluded from arguing waiver to this court.
Well, I am not clear that that's true. There's case law that supports the argument that if you don't say something in your 50B, there's a problem. But the question is, when you don't, I mean, I'm not clear that it was a preserved issue through the trial. Is there a fact issue involved in whether or not he's entitled? Normally in Louisiana, under Louisiana law, that's an issue for the jury. Whether the defendant, is going to get a discretionary immunity.
Well, I think it's a mixed
question. There was no jury instruction proposed by Gusman on the discretionary immunity defense.
That's correct. But the discretionary, here's what we think is the legal answer to this question for this court. There are numerous cases from this court and from every other circuit that says if you raise a defense in a 50B motion, it was not raised in the 50A motion, and the other side doesn't object and engages on the merits, which is what happened here, they are precluded. The language is precluded from relying on waiver. The issue was raised, that it was before the district court. The district court could have granted judgment as a matter of law and said discretionary immunity applies here. I'm going to grant the motion. But in order for this court to say waiver here, you would have to go against 5 cases from 1996 through 2007 that specifically say you're precluded from raising waiver.
Is that true with respect, this is genuinely a question. It's not from the standpoint of I know the answer and I want to see whether you do. Is that true with respect to an issue that has a factual component to it, or is that true with respect to issues of law?
I'm not sure of the answer to that.
Yeah.
My answer, though, on this is a mixed question of fact and law.
Right.
The facts here are undisputed with respect to emergency circumstances. The other side will say, no doubt, as they've said in their brief, that what actually caused the extended detention was the sheriff's policy was not to bring people over in time because the magistrates weren't meeting on weekends. And the jury specifically rejected that. The jury said, no, there's no policy here that per se violates the Fourth Amendment. In other words, the jury rejected the Monell claim against the sheriff's department. So the only basis that we can here find an illegal detention is 230.2, which has an emergency exception. The jury was instructed on it. Discretionary immunity was raised. It was raised in the answer. The jury was instructed on an emergency exception, which is distinct from discretionary immunity, but it's a component of it. The reason there's an emergency exception is because it allows the policymaker to have discretion about whether to go ahead and release them or not. And it was raised explicitly in the 50B motion, and the district court didn't say anything about waiver in its order denying the JMOL. The district court just said, well, didn't really say anything about it. It didn't say waiver. I see I have run out of time without talking about the Sixth Amendment. Let me just say in my closing 31 seconds that there is no question here, as a matter of law, there is no Sixth Amendment attachment. There were never adversarial judicial proceedings here. There was no critical phase. Probable cause hearing is not a critical phase. The Supreme Court said it in Rothbury, which I'm reversing this court, unfortunately. The Supreme Court said that in Louisiana, the adversarial judicial proceedings start at the 72-hour hearing, never got there here, and there's no critical phase. So there cannot be a Sixth Amendment violation. Qualified immunity should apply.
Okay.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Prendergast.
May it please the court, Brett Prendergast, along with John Murray, on behalf of the appellees, Robbie Wagenfield and Paul Kunkel. Judge Jolly, in the matter of Tompkins versus Sarr, when you were discussing the need to object to jury charges, you made a very cogent and I think central point to this case. You said that the need to object said they also reflect the central role of the United States District Court. It is not a way station or an entry gate. Rather, trials are at the heart of the system. Trial, not appeal, is the main event. The rules we enforce today tether these statements to reality. What the defendants before you today are attempting to do is have another trial, a different trial than the one we had. I remember the trial we had.
You were there.
I was there, Your Honor. I was at that trial. We introduced witnesses. We made arguments. We submitted jury charges. We did the whole thing. And now the defendants want a different trial. They want to have a trial about 1,200 people and possibly having to release 1,200 people out into the teeth of a hurricane. Your Honor, you asked whether or not these were 1,200 people who were arrested. They certainly were not 1,200 people arrested over that weekend. There, in fact, was no evidence introduced as to how many of these people were in the same situation as plaintiffs. It's fair to say that there weren't 1,200 people. How many there were, I don't know. The sheriff would have had that information. The sheriff could have introduced evidence to that. The sheriff chose not to do so. But there was also no evidence to suggest that even the 1,200 people hadn't already had probable cause determinations. Pretrial detainees that are held at Orleans Parish Prison include people who are recently arrested, as in the case of the plaintiffs, but it also includes people who may have been in jail for a while and gone through a lot of procedures. And, ironically enough, the one thing we know, the group that did receive probable cause determinations at this time were the more serious offenders. The state court offenders actually received probable cause determinations over the weekend. It was only instead the municipal offenders who weren't getting the benefit, the most petty of offenders. Likewise, the defendant wants the sheriff suggest that if the sheriff complied with the legal requirements of 230.2, he would have been required to throw these people out into the hurricane. I would ask a simple question. Why would he have been required to do that? Why could not he have just simply released the people from custody and made them free citizens of the United States again in compliance with 230.2? There were other civilians who were in that jail at the time. He could have told those people, okay, you're not getting your hearing, pursuant to 230.2, you need to be free. We can't let you shouldn't go out into the storm right now. If you choose to, that's your matter. But we're just going to let you be free. When we get to the overpass where we can evacuate you, you're a citizen. You're like a bunch of other Katrina refugees. Be on your way. Have a nice trip. So this notion that the only alternative was to either violate people's rights under 230.2 or to send them out into floodwaters is simply absurd. What our trial was about was simply two people, not 1,200. It was about two people who were arrested for a really minor crime of drunken public in the French Quarter.
It's quite clear you have a very sympathetic case.
It is. This is not that complicated of a matter. These are two people that the facts establish several things undisputedly. These people were arrested 5 a.m. on Saturday morning, August 27th. They were put into the custody of the sheriff. When they got into the custody of the sheriff, the telephones were not working. They were unable to make any
contact. Yeah, I think we're pretty well aware of the facts.
Right. The other thing I wanted to say about the causation and the question of whether or not these people would have received a probable cause determination, absent Katrina, Sheriff Gussman testified to that. Sheriff Gussman establishes that regardless of Katrina, these people are not receiving a hearing within 48 hours. They're not receiving a probable cause determination within 48 hours. So you can take Katrina out of the picture, and they're still going to have their rights violated under 230.2. Relative to the sheriff's assertion of discretionary immunity, you all have correctly noted that this matter was not raised up until the time of the 50B motion. It being a mixed question, as a defense counsel concedes, the question therefore...
Well, you know, in a way, I mean, the case, they did raise it if they raised the Riverside case in the sense that the Louisiana Supreme Court has tied the Riverside case to the immunity, the Louisiana immunity statute. And if they raised Riverside, then it was the same thing as raising it with respect to the state statute as well as to the federal statute.
I'd make two responses to that, Your Honor. One, I agree with Judge Wiener that there is a difference between discretionary immunity and an emergency exception under Riverside. Emergency exception under Riverside says the sheriff or the people who are holding someone in jail don't get to decide, oh, well, there's an emergency. The sheriff instead has the burden of proving that there's an emergency. So there's a difference between that and discretionary immunity and the exercise of discretion. Secondly, I disagree that the holding of the Louisiana Supreme Court in State versus Wallace, where they mentioned the idea of an emergency exception, is anything more than dicta. Chief Justice Rehnquist in Connecticut versus Dorr 501.
Yeah, but I agree. I mean that it's dicta. I mean, there's no,
yes.
I agree with that. Except, you know, dicta doesn't mean the Supreme Court hasn't spoken. It does mean that the Supreme Court hasn't held. Now, so the Supreme Court does give you some indication whenever they engage in some specific dicta here. And as I understand the Wallace case, it's tied specifically to the immunity, to the Louisiana immunity statute.
No, Your Honor. No, State versus Wallace makes no reference whatsoever to the Louisiana immunity statute.
What was involved in that case?
State versus Wallace involved a gentleman by the name of Wallace who was arrested. And more than 48 hours elapsed. He was not given a probable cause determination. When he finally arrived for his probable cause determination, the magistrate said three things. He said, well, one, I didn't get the paperwork until such and such a time, which was later than the time of arrest. Okay. He said, I'm making a probable cause determination now, and that's going to retroactively fix the fact that he didn't get it within 48 hours. And three, he said the police made the probable cause determination at the time they arrested him.
I get it.
That's the three things that the Louisiana Supreme Court addressed in State versus Wallace, and that's the three things they
rejected. But they were addressing the 48-hour.
They were
when they spoke of an exception.
They weren't speaking of exceptions at all, Your Honor.
Well, they were applying Riverside.
They were applying Riverside, but
to the 48-hour rule.
They were citing Riverside along with 230.2 as a source of a requirement that you receive a probable cause determination within 48 hours. Both Riverside and 230.2 require a probable cause determination within 48 hours. What I am saying is, because the issue of an emergency never came up, had absolutely nothing to do with State versus Wallace, the Louisiana Supreme Court was never called upon to address whether 230.2 contained an emergency exception. Because if it...
Oh, I agree. I'm not...
Because the question becomes, Your Honor, and I would ask defense counsel, if they tell me that there's an emergency exception in 230.2, I would ask them, where is it in the language? The language makes no such suggestion for an emergency exception. The only thing that they have to rely upon is the dicta in Wallace. Even...
But what would you say, I mean, for example, if on the way to the magistrate hearing, they had a wreck in which the individual defendant was hospitalized for 3 days before they got him back to the magistrate for a hearing. Mm-hmm. Would you say then that the sheriff was liable for false imprisonment?
I would say if the sheriff doesn't release him within the 48-hour period, yes, Your Honor, he'd be liable for false imprisonment. And the reason I would say that is because 230.2 is a choice the Louisiana legislature made. The Louisiana legislature specifically put in 230.2 48 hours or release, but they also put in their provisions that the probable cause determination, one, we refer to it as a hearing. It doesn't have to be a hearing. Two, it's non-adversarial. And three, the defendant doesn't have to be present. And I think there's a reasoned basis to say that because they put in these other manners to conduct the hearing without the presence of the defendant there, there really is no excuse for not getting that determination made. Well, in the same way,
if they were on the way, say, and they were just detained by virtue of the accident, and they were late for say 30 minutes, and you're saying the same result would obtain.
I'm saying, okay. According to the reading of 230.2, they should release that individual.
Okay.
And it's the same way as in Wallace mentions the State versus.
I mean, irrespective of the crime he committed. They would release that individual.
Well, he's not acquitted. He's only released on his own cognizance.
He's only released on his own recognizance. And the other thing is, as the court has made clear, both in 230.2 and in Riverside, the mere fact that somebody is released on pursuant to the 48-hour rule doesn't mean it has no impact on the prosecution whatsoever. The state is free completely to continue to go ahead and prosecute that individual.
Even though he's absconded to, wow.
Your Honor,
it just seems foolish, that's all.
Well, and to change the example that he gave, suppose the problem was that the magistrate judge couldn't get to the jail because there was an impending hurricane and he had the good judgment to leave, unlike your clients. So that might be the kind of an emergency where you couldn't hold a hearing because the holder was not around.
But again, Your Honor, I do want to emphasize there is no requirement for a hearing. These determinations are made simply on the paper.
There's no magistrate judge to make the determination on paper, never mind the hearing. There's
right.
Just nobody there to sign. That's the way we call it.
And Your Honor, if someone was arrested on a Monday, let's say the Monday morning of Hurricane Katrina, then there might be an issue relative to an emergency exception if the emergency exception applied to 230.2.
But you say it doesn't.
I say it doesn't, Your Honor, yes.
Exactly.
But in this case, even if you apply an emergency exception, that's not the cause in fact for why there was no probable cause determination.
Because there wasn't going to be one on time no matter what.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There simply was not going to be a probable cause determination.
Well, that gets back to my introductory question, and that is what we're really talking about is the release after 48 hours. That was never suspended.
No, Your Honor.
If there was an emergency suspension, it would have been about the probable cause hearing, And so without a hearing or a ruling, then there's no suspension for the release, so they were entitled to release.
They were entitled to go free because...
On their own recognizance.
On their own recognizance because, as the court said in Riverside...
I mean, that's almost absurd, though. I mean, an absurd reading of the statute.
Why, Your Honor?
Well, if you had a violent murderer that had been arrested and you don't comply with this law, you turn him loose immediately, and he absconds somewhere else and starts a serial killing again. Because you didn't take him there before.
Misdemeanors.
230.2 applies to all crimes. In this particular case, in order to avoid the horror scenario that you're discussing, Your Honor, that's why magistrate court, a criminal court in Orleans Parish, that's why they have weekend hearings.
Yeah.
That's why they do
it's
that.
It's not for this type of customer.
Right.
I'm just saying, applying the statute in the way you're talking about, assuming that the magistrate wasn't there on the weekend, he would be released to continue to kill. And I'm saying that's absurd.
Well, Your Honor, the only thing I can say in response to that is it's a fundamental principle of Louisiana law that if a statute is clear on its face, that's the way it's supposed to be interpreted, and that's the way it's supposed to be applied. In the language, the Louisiana Supreme Court,
except in emergency situations,
the Louisiana Supreme Court labeled this statute as particularly straightforward in what it requires.
I'm just saying that there has to be some exception, but you have made it very clear and unequivocal that there are no exceptions under any circumstances to the application of that statute. And that's
Your Honor, I simply, by reading the statute, 230.2, I don't see an exception. However, let me also add that I don't believe that's the matter before this court.
Yeah.
This court doesn't have to decide whether or not, in all circumstances involving the most egregious, horrific offenders, 230.2 allows for no exceptions. This court doesn't have to decide that. That's not the issue presented. Also, defense counsel cited the case of Wuerl involving a false arrest and saying, oh, the sheriff isn't responsible for as soon as he learns that he doesn't have a basis to hold an arrestee any longer. I urge you all to read Wuerl, because Wuerl actually says what a sheriff's obligation is to verify that he has a basis to hold people. Wuerl says that a sheriff should know by what authority he is holding everybody in his jail. The delay in Wuerl was a situation where the charges had been dismissed against Mr. Wuerl. I'm not sure if it was Mr. Wuerl or whoever the defendant in the matter was. The charges were dismissed. And that information was then relayed to the sheriff, and that sheriff really messed up and held that person for 9 months. Here, the person who's absolutely aware that the 48 hours is passing, the very moment it passes, is Sheriff Gussman. I would also like to point out there is no inconsistency between a finding of no liability under the Fourth Amendment and a finding of liability under the state claim. First of all, there is the whole issue of that the statute provides for no exception, whereas Riverside does. Additionally, if you would look at the answers to the jury interrogatory, specifically question number 2 versus question number 38, which are the two questions dealing with Fourth Amendment versus false imprisonment, I think we made a mistake in allowing the jury to get confused on the issue of when that we were holding Sheriff Gussman responsible for the fact that there weren't hearings taking place. I think the question misled the jury in that direction, when in fact Sheriff Gussman's responsibility was to release in the absence of a hearing. And I think that the question led them to believe that we were asking them to hold the sheriff accountable for the fact that the municipal court wasn't holding court. Very quickly, as to the Sixth Amendment, one can argue about the extent that discretionary immunity was in the 50B. The allegation or the claim that the plaintiffs did not have a Sixth Amendment right to counsel was never, ever raised in the trial court. It wasn't raised in the 50A motion, it wasn't raised in the 50B motion. Likewise, the issue was never, ever raised that the right wasn't clearly established. Instead, with the consent of the defendants, the jury was charged that the plaintiffs had a Sixth Amendment right and that any telephone restrictions that unreasonably interfered with that right was a violation of the Sixth Amendment. There was no objection to that charge. And the issue was simply never, ever raised. Also, I think that defense counsel mistakenly...
Well, I guess they did have a right to Sixth Amendment counsel at some point down the road.
Well, Your Honor, I would maintain that they had a right to Sixth Amendment counsel. Once that affidavit's filed in municipal court in New Orleans, that is the same as the filing of an indictment or a bill of information. That's what starts the process running. I see that I'm out of time. I thank you. We'd ask that the judgment, the verdict of the jury, and the judgment of the trial court be affirmed.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Let me start by reading the decree from the Wallace case. So I hope we can put this issue to rest. This is the decree from the Louisiana Supreme Court. In the absence of a bona fide emergency or other extreme circumstances, comma, all persons arrested without a warrant for whom a probable cause determination is not made within 48 hours must be immediately released from custody on their own recognizance. The statute says what it says. The Louisiana Supreme Court has interpreted it. This court's bound by that interpretation. I'm not sure there's anything else to say about it. There's an emergency exception. Not only that, but the jury was charged that there was an emergency exception to 230.2. It's page 1078 and 1079 of the jury. Let's assume for a second that you find that the sheriff waived any reliance on discretionary immunity. Our alternate argument is that the jury's verdict that there was an illegal detention is supported by no evidence or is contradicted by the overwhelming weight of the evidence. You could still find that. Because there is, the evidence in this case is that Katrina hit during the 48-hour period. There is no contradictory evidence to that. And the jury verdict that there was an illegal detention in the face of an instruction that there's an emergency exception to the 48-hour rule simply cannot stand.
What do you say about their argument, though, that in no event would he have ever received the 48-hour, would they have ever received the 48-hour hearing because the practice was not to give them a 48-hour hearing over the weekend.
That was their main argument below. The jury rejected it. Here's the jury's response to question 32. Do you find by preponderance that Sheriff Guzman, et cetera, had a policy, practice, or custom of deliberate indifference to arrest an individual's right to have a probable cause determination made by an impartial judge or magistrate within 48 hours? That's question 32 at page 523 of the record, and the jury responded no and no. That theory is not on the table.
Well, it's not his failing.
Well, the jury found that he had no policy that resulted in the denial of 48 hour. So the interface.
What is the deal? I mean, who is it that's supposed to provide this magistrate? It's not the sheriff.
No, the municipal court is supposed to provide them. And you know, to be fair, you can read the Wallace. You have already read the Wallace opinion. There are problems with the magistrate practices in Orleans Parish.
Well, apart from the emergency exception. The sheriff knows, does he not, that if the municipal court doesn't provide that hearing, that he has no choice but to release these people.
That's correct, in the absence of an emergency, yes. That's right. And the sheriff testified to that effect. Now, he, as you might expect, he emphasized the emergency exception to Riverside.
Yeah, and of course, but the fact that that the hearing's provided by the municipal court and the magistrates there doesn't affect the sheriff's clear-cut, black-and-white responsibility.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Now, in my remaining time, let me say a word about preclusion, which is the failure to raise discretionary immunity in the 50A as opposed to the 50B motion. In numerous cases, this court has used language. Like this is language from the Arsamit case, which this court decided in 2005. These are cited at pages 4, 5, and 6 of our reply brief. The court says, where the non-movement fails to raise forfeiture in opposition to a 50B motion, quote, this failure precludes raising the forfeiture claim on appeal. So there is no, they're raising a forfeiture claim, and we say they're precluded. Back to just a second, I've got 1 minute, about qualified immunity. First of all, the defendants proposed a jury instruction on the Sixth Amendment that said you're not entitled to Sixth Amendment counsel except for assistance with interrogation and questioning. The court didn't give that instruction. Instead, the court gave this generic instruction that said Sixth Amendment detainees may be, I'm sorry, let me, the jury instruction says that restrictions on a detainee's telephone privileges that prevent him from contacting an attorney violate his constitutional right to counsel. That's at page 1078 and 79 of the record. Well, that may be true. As a general matter, that's true. But as a more specific matter, under these uncontested facts, there was no Sixth Amendment that ever attached. There was no critical phase that was ever reached. There was no Sixth Amendment right. As far as whether we raise the argument, we raised qualified immunity numerous times. And this court has said, for instance, in the Modica case, and other circuits have said it as well, that when you raise qualified immunity, the burden shifts to the plaintiffs to explain why it doesn't apply. And this court can address either prong as a matter of law on appeal. So for those reasons, we ask for reversal on the basis of primarily immunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Court will be in recess until tomorrow afternoon at 1:00.